From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today on the show, a look at Milwaukee's annual Summit on Poverty, which will, in part, tackle the topic of environmental justice. Then, in honor of Mental Health Awareness Week, we speak with two advocates who have their own experiences with mental health issues.
I was absolutely clueless about what I was even experiencing. And that kept me from admitting it to anyone, because if you don't even understand what you're going through, how are you going to explain it to someone else?
We learn about a group of Latino Milwaukeeans studying to become U.S. citizens. Plus, a new book about the Green Bay Packers goes far beyond football and looks at Vince Lombardi's support for the team's African-American players.
He had a meeting with the local restaurateurs and the local bar owners, where he said that if you deny service to any of my black players, you're not going to get business from any of my players.
Lake Effect is next, but first, the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Joy Powers. Driving down poverty and increasing wellness, those are among the critical challenges being tackled at Milwaukee's annual Summit on Poverty. The two-day program is a collaboration between Marquette University and the Social Development Commission. It's designed to foster creative conversations among community leaders, educators, and members of the community. Dr. Monica White is one of the summit's keynote speakers. White is a professor at UW-Madison, and she teaches courses in environmental justice, urban agriculture, and community systems. She spoke with Lake Effect's Susan Bentz and explains how her research has been influenced in part by growing up in Detroit, Michigan.
So having been raised in Detroit and graduated from high school, and then returning to care for my parents, I needed a research idea that would, you know, that was, you know, applying for positions in Detroit. I wanted to find a research idea that was understudied. And what I recognized was that while the city of Detroit was being recognized as, you know, a community that was reconnecting to, you know, or just reestablishing urban agricultural roots and, you know, creating these community gardens and these growing spaces, as a part of the the city's response to the automobile decline, what was key to me was, as I looked at the stories and who were the people that were being presented, it was often folks who were not from Detroit and often were not African-American, given the percentage of African-American community in the, you know, if the African-American community is over 80-some-odd% at that particular time, then how can all the stories about folks that are growing food in the city, very few people were willing to talk about African-Americans who were doing this. And so I felt like there was a voice that was being overlooked. And I wanted to use my research skills to make sure to add the voices of those who were overlooked, the African-Americans who had been, many of whom had left the South during the Great Migration, one of the Great Migrations, moved to the North and continued to grow in backyards. And then in the 70s began to grow in community gardens and other city initiatives that encouraged folks to grow food as a strategy of toward making sure that families had nutrient-rich foods.
Part of your aim is to support food justice, providing the scholarship that helps to develop strategies and expand its reach. Would that be accurate?
Well, I mean, I think it's, you know, to expand the reach based on our historical connections, or rethinking our historical connections, offering a counter narrative to our historic connections to food production and the environment. So for me, it seems that a lot of the scholarship, when you think about Black farmers, a lot of the language around that has often been sharecropping, tenant farming, and slavery. And while these are a part of our historical legacies, there have also been other folks who have used agriculture as a strategy of resistance and resilience, as people in Detroit, Milwaukee, Chicago, New Orleans are doing. And I felt like the scholarship did not support the kind of work that they were doing in this moment. And I just knew in my heart that there had to be a way to explain why turning to agriculture was important, and who have been the other models, examples, and historical figures who were involved in, demanding access to land, fighting the dispossession against, entities that were trying to dispossess African Americans from their land. And so I wanted to provide a counter narrative, one that could support food justice activists today and those who are working towards self-provisioning as a strategy of community resilience.
This summit, which you'll be a part of, aims to be a catalyst of change, to create a safe place for well-informed, honest discussion. We as communities, many facets of our society, have so much work to do. Are there straightforward strategies that we're missing as a society?
So I think in responding to this, as somebody who asks questions for a living, I think that Chimamanda Adichie's conversation around the danger of a single story is really important here. If we're often thinking of, so just as a backstory, Susan, I'm talking to my students in class yesterday, I'm sort of helping them to frame the argument around why it's important to listen to folks that are food insecure to understand what they believe as the solutions to food inaccessibility. I think often what happens is we have two ways of thinking or understanding and articulating the fact that communities and families go hungry. One is the question of do they have the education to prepare nutrient-rich foods? And two, are the establishments in close proximity for folks to access nutrient-rich foods? And I think that both of these tend to look at the person who's food insecure as the cause of food insecurity, opposed to a structure. We grow and produce enough food to feed the world many times over. The problem isn't food production. It's often food distribution based on the idea that some people deserve some quality of food while others deserve a different quality of food. And a lot of that is based on categories that we as sociologists study, race, class, gender, nationality, and what have you. If you believe that food should be a human right, the way we feed communities would be very different than the structure that we have right now. Right now, we have a system that benefits off of exploitation and unequal access of food resources to some communities opposed to others. And that, I think, is a problem. Now, the solution to me, there are many solutions, some of which are structural, but what I am most encouraged by, the voices of those who are responding to and identifying strategies to meet their own family and community's needs. And many of those organizations are the ones that I talked about in Freedom Farmers, Agricultural Resistance, and the Black Freedom Movement.
Is it acknowledging the mechanisms, the organizations, the leaders who already exist in neighborhoods and communities, and then listening to them, learning from them, and adding, just participating a bit?
To me, I truly believe that most communities have the solutions to whatever the conditions are that inhibit their or impede the possibilities for progress. I think every community knows what the problems are and already has a sense of what those solutions are. It's often that they're disconnected from the mechanisms of power to make those solutions become a reality. I see these organizations that are creating food hubs and alternative food networks and food preservation and community preparation mechanisms as a way that a community engages, actually participates in their own solutions. And so watching community organizations create community growing spaces, value-added products, means that they're showing us by example in small ways, how is it that we can feed a hungry community nutrient-rich food at a different price point than what the market would tell us. And so we look at having a whole healthy, happy community opposed to what is the profit margin? How do we decide based on economics? It is this reality that if food is a human right, then what is the mechanism? And while there are many mechanisms, community members are standing up and speaking on their own behalf.
What is environmental justice to you? How do you see it? And how does it need to be? How do we get there?
Yeah. So for me, environmental justice recognizes that all of us ask for things from the earth. And while we all ask for things of the earth, there are some of us who enjoy its benefits and others who suffer from the consequences. So for me, environmental justice is an effort, an attempt to raise the awareness that everyone isn't equally experiencing the benefits and the disadvantages of our use of the Earth's resources. And it is an acknowledgement that organizations, communities, and residents are speaking out against various kinds of inequities with regard to the benefits and the disadvantages. And so a justice movement would be recognizing that the folks in Barbados did not cause climate change, but their island is now decimated and they're forced to adjust to a different, we have to recognize climate migrants as a reality. Folks are going to be forced from their homes as a result of climate change and the effects of weather disasters that are impacting certain communities. And while it's important to recognize that the people of Barbados didn't cause this to happen, but they are the victims, that's an example of environmental racism. And the justice movement asks us to to recognize that everyone isn't equally impacted by our use and misuse of the environmental resources. Is that helpful?
Yeah, definitely. So when you lead a discussion on environmental justice, is your approach to start with the assets?
Absolutely.
And so is poverty automatically part of that conversation, or do you think that...
Put a pause on the poverty question for just a second. I think that for me, let me say this. I think what I know is that often as researchers, we're taught to identify a problem. And if we're taught to identify a problem, then that's the beginning of sort of looking at things to me from a deficit approach. In other words, if I come to your house and I say, well, that's wrong, how does that make you feel? I stand against that in terms of my own research approach because I believe that every community, every entity has something upon which to build. So I take I approach my research question from an asset approach, which means every community has something upon which to build. And it just sometimes takes us to look for what are the strengths of a particular community to understand the ways that we might respond to food access and insecurity in a way that leaves that community feeling better. So going in saying what's wrong is very different than saying, here are the assets upon which we can build. What is the vision for our community and how do we want to move in that direction? So the latter is more of what I do in terms of an asset-based approach that allows a community to think about the strengths, to think about what are our, what is our vision for the future and what are the mechanisms that allow us to get there. And I think it leaves people feeling more empowered having had that discussion than one that is focused on what's wrong. Having said that, Susan, I think that this question about poverty is disconnected, right? So on the one hand, EJ is not caused by people who are impoverished.
That being environmental justice.
It's experienced by those who are impoverished. And so recognizing the ways that poverty actually contributes to the consumption of environmental toxins, such as the example of Flint. Residents of Flint had been telling us there was something wrong with the water. We ignored them. And had they not been, had the city not been experiencing the kinds of economic impact, then we probably would have listened a lot sooner. So to me, the question of poverty puts an analysis of environmental justice in a different frame. Poverty is the outcome of an unfair system, and poverty creates a mechanism for exploitation, contamination, and exposure to environmental toxins. It's not a solution. It's part of the problem. I mean, I think, a lot of folks that are active in the food justice movement are not food insecure. A lot of folks that are involved in these justice movements are not those who experience the condition that they're speaking on behalf of, which is part of the problem. So how do we make sure that we elevate the voices, the solutions, the ideas of those who experience whatever social phenomena we call ourselves, in support of? And so I think that that's a very different orientation to understanding movements, but also it's a different orientation as an academic to study what we identify as a particular social condition is by actually listening to the voices of those who live this on a day-to-day. I think your research questions are very different, and the ideas that you come up with will be very different than if you're only exposed to academic environments.
With the research, the teaching, the speaking that you do around the world, where do you see the pockets of most promise and things that we as a society might really gravitate to?
All right. Yeah, I'm excited and encouraged by young people who are concerned about their future and their search for solutions, solutions that feel fair, just, and whole. And I'm encouraged by the ways that I see young people engaging with community organizations and using whatever voice, whatever privilege they have, whatever energy to organize around, truly, genuinely a better tomorrow. I'm encouraged by young people.
Dr. Monica White is an associate professor of environmental justice at UW-Madison, and she's one of the keynote speakers at the 2019 Summit on Poverty. Her talk will be tomorrow morning at Marquette University. You can find more information about the summit and Dr. Monica White at WUWM.com. We'll take a short break, and then coming up, in honor of Mental Health Awareness Week, we're joined by two advocates who share their own experiences with mental health issues. This is Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues now on WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Amy Osorio Ayala and Amy Rupnik are both students here in Milwaukee. Both women share a Latinx heritage. Osorio Ayala was born in Puerto Rico, and Rupnik is of Brazilian descent. And they both have something else in common: personal experiences with mental health issues. In honor of Mental Health Awareness Week, WUWM reporter Angelina Mosher Salazar sat down with these young women to talk about their experiences and creating mental health awareness in the Latinx community.
So, Amira, you mentioned that you are Brazilian.
Yes.
And Amy, if I'm not mistaken, you're Puerto Rican.
Yes.
You're born in Puerto Rico.
Yes.
One thing that I want to talk about that I think doesn't often get a lot of attention is mental health awareness in the Latino community.
Absolutely. I can definitely agree that it is something that is not spoken about. And I think it's because a lot of people, for one, are not educated on it and how to be able to help those that are suffering. But also it's seen as a bad thing. It's like a bad word. Like, mm-hmm. No, there's no reason why you should be depressed. There's no reason why you should feel this way. Especially because us women in the Latino community, we do so much. We're mothers, we're sisters, we work, we're students. And it's very difficult to have a day off, quote unquote, to be able to feel how we feel.
Absolutely.
Like I was saying earlier, it's something like we're seen as locas. We're seen as it's crazy for you to, you can't say that. You can't feel that way. So
and loca means crazy for our non-Spanish speaking audience that that's what you call somebody who is, experiencing symptoms of a mental illness. It's just like a crazy person.
Or no esté amargada. Like don't be so bitter. And it's like, not only just for women. I know there are men out there who also feel this way. Just in the Latino community in general, it's just something that, because Latinos, we're just very vibrant. So mm-hmm. it's not right, quote unquote, for you to not be vibrant. It's kind of so different. It's like, what are you doing? Don't be that way. So it's a stigma in the Latino community. Absolutely.
I do want to dive deep into this term, mental health. What does that mean? Okay, if we're gonna bring more awareness to this, if we're gonna talk about this, like is that just like you're depressed? Does that mean, you're suicidal? Does that even include things like anxiety that is under the umbrella of mental health awareness? So, Amy, can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yes. So, mental health really is the umbrella of several illnesses. It does include depression, suicidal thoughts, or just suicide in general. Anxiety, I know it has OCD, BDD, which we will shortly speak about. And there's many more illnesses that go undiagnosed and untreated. And because they do go undiagnosed, they are pushed aside, kind of like, oh no, it's not as important as the other ones. But mental health awareness is really just a movement to be able to bring it up to the surface and give the people that are struggling the space to speak about it and seek help. I have a few statistics if I can.
Yeah, absolutely.
So 1 in 5 adults live with mental illness. It's highest among women. 22% of women struggle with it. And there's about 15% of men who struggle with it. And I also have that depression has risen 18% in the last decade. And half of those people are untreated. I have a huge problem with that. When I was about 18, I was off my mom's healthcare. And I, at that time, I was still struggling with depression where I didn't leave the house. I did not do anything. I actually dropped out of college at that time, didn't have a job. So I literally spent my life for the 4 or 5 months at home and not being able to see my doctor and not being able to tell someone like I'm struggling, I don't know what to do, was really tough. And it ties back into being the oldest and having to perform, having to not be that person at home because my siblings would see that. And it's like, I don't want to have that effect on them. I don't want them to think, you know, this is the life of a depressive person. So it really does put a strain on my heart.
Mm. Thank you so much for sharing Thank you, Amy. And for just bringing some more awareness. Amita, I know that you want to talk about something that isn't so well known, like depression or anxiety or suicide, something that kind of flies under the mental health awareness radar.
Yes, so that's body dysmorphic disorder, BDD for short, or body dysmorphia. So body dysmorphia is a severe mental disorder where a lot of the features are similar to OCD and eating disorders. You're being preoccupied basically with a perceived or imagined physical defect that you have. It's typically things that other people don't notice or can't see. That includes always seeking reassurance from people or...
Like saying like, hey, does my skin look good? Or does this outfit look good?
It's even negative. Like, does my skin look this bad? Or do I look too big in this? Do I look too small in this? It's rarely positive things, you know, because...
Okay.
Yeah, so it's that constantly checking any reflection you see yourself in. Also grooming. So, you know, fixing, adjusting your clothes or fixing your makeup or adding makeup or something like that. The average of how many hours a day anyone with body dysmorphia focuses on their appearance is about 8 to 10 hours a day.
Wow.
No one talks about it.
Mm.
So that leaves people in the dark about it, but it also leaves the people that are actually suffering from it in the dark about it. I do have some statistics.
Absolutely. Let's share them.
So there are 200,000 cases a year of people with body dysmorphia, and that's only reported. So I did mention body dysmorphia is very underdiagnosed. So this number, we don't even know if it could be way higher, a little bit higher. 80% experience lifetime suicide ideation. Yeah.
Well, I know that you have a very personal tie to this disorder.
So I've suffered from body dysmorphia since I was about 13 years old, which is actually common for people. It's younger. It's getting younger and younger. I was absolutely clueless about what I was even experiencing, and that kept me from admitting it to anyone because if you don't even understand what you're going through, how are you going to explain it to someone else? But before my freshman year of college, I reached a point where I felt like I was actually in danger. When you're experiencing suicidal ideation, you're not thinking like, wow, this is normal for me every day, you know? And then when you step back and you're like, that's not normal. And at that point is when I felt like the suicidal thoughts were just getting more intrusive to the point where I didn't feel safe. And that really pushed me to address that I was struggling. So I opened up to my mom about it. So she's very encouraging and she directed me to the next step. So I went to my pediatrician at the time and he referred me to a specific clinic that specializes in eating disorder treatment. So what they did was they conducted a screening to determine what kind of help I needed because it is very different. Like everyone suffers differently. So that process really showed me, I guess, the severity of what I was actually going through. And then that's when I discovered that the problem that I was struggling with was body dysmorphia. you hope there's other people that you can relate to.
You didn't want to be alone.
No, of course not. Because you already feel alone, like completely alone, even though you may not be alone. And it affects me personally still till this day, of course, including my personal self-esteem, and that I really tend to base my worth off of how I look. So I could do anything. Like, I could do well in school. I could help someone out. And, you know, that doesn't matter. You just throw that out. You're like, oh, okay, but this.
So all of your achievements seem minor.
Oh, absolutely.
Or pale in comparison.
Yeah.
Because I need to look a certain way.
Yep. And if I don't, then I failed. It's not looking at the things you're actually doing, you know? Examples. So for me personally, it's hard to get out of bed. There are some days where I can't physically even get out of bed because you're just thinking. You're like, the rest of my day, I'm going to be thinking about this. And you don't want to do that. But then you end up sitting in bed, not doing anything, not being productive in any way. Simple tasks become difficult and sometimes feel like the end of the world. Like, oh, going to the bathroom, brushing your teeth, taking a shower. It's just dreadful. It's like, it's almost like you're so exhausted that you just want to lay there and just be miserable, you know?
And can you help me understand a little bit, why is it so difficult? Why are those simple tasks so difficult? Is it because you're going to see yourself in the mirror, or is it because you're just like, I don't even want to go outside, or walk me a little bit through those feelings?
Well, personally, from my experience, I can honestly say that I worry about how I look almost all day. It'll determine my day. So if I'm not feeling good about how I'm looking, my entire day is shifted, you know, because it's based on that one, do you look good or not? Or is this thing that you're imagining there or not? But it's like that battle, like in your head, like, do I want to ignore these thoughts and just go on with my day? But then, you know, sometimes you don't win. Yeah. Sometimes
and
you do let
cutting
it.
Into that too, for me personally at 17, 18, it was more of like a self-punishment.
Yeah.
Like you said, when you don't perform from what you believe you're supposed to perform and you don't perform, you fail. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like you don't deserve to get out of bed today. You don't.
Yeah.
For me, that's how it was. Like,
absolutely.
I was punishing myself. Like, you don't deserve to take a shower today, kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And it's so disheartening to feel that way, like to look back and like, oh my gosh, I was that.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's how bad mental illness got to me, that I thought that I didn't deserve little basic tasks. So that was how I felt.
Yeah. That is a big part in it. It's like, do you deserve to even go on about your day? So I was a junior last year, my first semester, I believe, of junior year was the hardest one for me. So my body dysmorphia really jeopardized my school and work life around that time. I would skip lectures. I would be so exhausted with life that I would come home and sleep, wouldn't do homework or anything, and it affected my grades really bad. There were times where I'd feel so unmotivated that I would call in sick to work because I just couldn't. You know, I just couldn't go interact with people. Simple, like a simple little task. And my social life, currently, I mean, it still gets affected because, I mean, I've had many fallouts with friends because they don't understand it. You know, they don't understand the crippling disorder, like how crippling it is. And, you know, sometimes, like I said, you can't get out of bed. You make all these plans, but you're like, when the plans come, you're like, I can't.
Yeah.
I can't do it. Sometimes even texting a friend back is effort, and it's exhausting and draining. And, you know, they take that personally. And I mean, as a person that doesn't understand it, how else would you take it, you know? So, yeah, it did affect a lot in that aspect for me. That's why, though, it's so important for me to spread awareness to it so that, let's say someone is doing that to you, you can at least be like, okay, maybe they're really going through something. What can I do to help? Instead of, you know, taking it personally and then cutting off ties with people that, you know, meant a lot to you. So yeah, there are a lot of people that it affects, and also those people are in the dark about it too.
Thank you so much for sharing that, Amira. I do know that both of you occupy the spaces that you do right now because you are driven and motivated by your personal experiences. Amy, you want to talk a little bit about what you're doing and the events that you're attending to help spread more awareness about mental health?
Yes. So I actually utilize social media a lot to be able to broadcast, like she said, very important topics that are not really delved into. So on Instagram, I kind of share a lot of that, videos and stuff like that. But there is an event October 8th from 12 to 5 at the Medical College of Wisconsin at their campus, and it's the 8th annual Depression Day event. This is the first time that I hear about it. My psychology professor actually told us to go, so I have to take notes and kind of get a grade on it. But I feel like it's a plus for me because of how I dealt with depression, but also in order to increase my kind of like my studies on depression, if there's anything that I need to learn that I didn't know at age 17 or 18, to, like how Amira says, educate other people, to really open up that space for mental health awareness.
And do you think, is this something that's open to the public that maybe our listeners could attend? Maybe even if they don't, you know, suffer from depression personally, maybe they have a coworker or a friend that deals with this and it could better educate them. I don't know. Yes. What do you think?
Yes. So it is open to the public. I do have more information because some people do have to RSVP. It's going to be very informative. So I'm excited to attend.
Well, again, thank you so much, ladies, for coming into the studio and for trying to, you know, shed light on this very important week, which is Mental Health Awareness Week.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you.
Adios. Ciao. To everyone.
Ciao, everyone.
Amy Osorio Ayala is a student at MATC, and Amy Rupnik is a student at UWM. They spoke with WUWM's Angelina Mosher Salazar, and you can find more of our coverage on this issue at WUWM.com. Coming up, we learn about a group of Latino Milwaukeeans who are studying to become U.S. citizens. That's when Lake Effect returns on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues now on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. President Donald Trump has made reshaping immigration the centerpiece of his 2016 campaign, his presidency, and his 2020 re-election bid. On Milwaukee's South Side, a group of Latino immigrants are responding in a way that perhaps was not anticipated. They are studying to become U.S. citizens. We learn more from journalist and producer Barbara Miner.
My first hour in office, those people are gone.
President Trump tweeting out just hours ago that ICE will begin the process of removing millions of undocumented immigrants starting next week.
And you can call it deported if you want.
Every week, two dozen or so Latinos meet on Milwaukee's South Side, studying to become U.S. citizens. It is an often unnoticed response to the current political climate. The Latino population, or to use a gender-neutral term preferred by many millennials, the Latinx population, has grown steadily over the years. Today, it accounts for almost 20% of Milwaukee's population. Discrimination has always been an issue, but since the 2016 election, concerns have multiplied. Maria, who has lived in Milwaukee for 40 years, explains it this way.
No pensaba que era necesario.
I didn't used to think it was necessary, but now I do. I feel it's important for me to become a citizen.
The citizenship classes are run by the community group Voces de la Frontera and focus on the civics test that is part of the citizenship interview. On a recent Wednesday, the students ranged from youth in their 20s to seniors well past the age of Medicare. All were focused on learning the answers, and many on improving their English.
What is one responsibility that is only for U.S. citizens? When was the Constitution written? Written? Written?
¿Cómo se llama?
What is the name of the current president of the United States?
Donald Trump.
In asking the students why they wanted to become U.S. citizens, several talked about the chance for better jobs, for a better education, for a better life for their children. But there was one overwhelming response. They want to vote. Para votar.
They want to vote.
Para votar. Pues porque me di cuenta que es muy necesario.
I realized that the vote of Hispanics was very important.
Para votar por mis representantes.
To vote for my representatives, to have a voice and a vote.
Siempre es importante.
It is always important to vote. But now, it is more important.
Barbara Miner is a local journalist, and she produced this piece for Lake Effect. You can find more of our reporting on immigration at WUWM.com. We'll take one last break and then learn about The People's Team, a new book that looks at the last century of Packers football. Lake Effect returns in just a moment on WUWM. More of Lake Effect now on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers. Watching the Green Bay Packers is a regular part of fall for many Wisconsinites. But the Packers aren't just about football. At least not according to Mark Beach. He's the author of a new book titled The People's Team. Beach is also a former writer for Sports Illustrated, and his book is 400 pages of Packers. He takes a century deep dive into the franchise's history, to founders like Curly Lambeau and George Whitney Calhoun, to recent executives like Bob Harlan, Ron Wolf, and Mark Murphy. And of course, it looks at the players, both well-behaved and, well, not so much. Beach told WUWM's Chuck Kornbach that the Packers' connection to community is unmatched.
There really is no other team that I could come up with in North American pro sports that is as much of the place from which they come. They're defined by, Curly Lambeau is the descendant of immigrants from Belgium. George Whitney Calhoun is the grandson of a Minuteman. There's connections there. There's old Yankees and new immigrants. There's all sorts of wonderful things about Green Bay that make the Packers unique. You know, prohibition was not a popular thing in Green Bay in the 20s, but it's one of the primary reasons for the survival of the team, because there was no stop that was more popular in the early days of the NFL than Green Bay, because it was not a hard place to get a drink. The Union Hotel in De Pere started basement speakeasy rooms, but never finished them for the simple reason that the bar upstairs never stopped serving alcohol because they didn't have to. You know, the toleration of alcohol was tacitly endorsed by the city fathers and by the citizens of the town. And so in all sorts of ways, the Packers are defined by the city of Green Bay, and the city of Green Bay is, of course, now defined by the team.
And even non-Packer fans in Green Bay and elsewhere usually have at least some sort of knowledge of who the team is, what the team is, what they do. Is that right?
Oh, sure. I mean, you know, the Packers are all over, right? You know, the house where Curly Lambeau was born still stands. City Stadium, where the Packers played from 1925 through 1956, is still there. You know, that one of the defining events in the life of the Packers was the injury to Ed Rigney Dwyer, who was one of the original Packers in 1919. And in 1920, he worked on the rail yards of the Milwaukee Road. And he was run over by a train car. And there was a tremendous outpouring of support in the community. And the Packers played a benefit game. They split into two squads and played a benefit game that raised the equivalent of about $50,000 today. But Rigney Dwyer was injured in the Milwaukee Road yards, which are still, you know, south of South Oakland Avenue on the west side of the river. You pass over them, all the time when you drive in Green Bay. There's parts of that team all over that town. It's not just in the, in Lambeau Field, in the Stadium District now, in the Titletown District now, which is another sort of unique legacy of the team itself.
That's sort of the economic development area surrounding the stadium. There are more, the Packers trying to get even more revenue, is that right?
Well, that's right. I mean, the Packers are trying to get more revenue, but they're also trying to ensure that Green Bay remains a viable place for, as Mark Murphy told me, Green Bay remains a viable home for the Packers. You know, the town for so long was the wet nurse of the team and ensured the team's survival many times. You know, Cliff Kristol, the team's historian who wrote for the Green Bay Press-Gazette for many years, has explained to me the relationship between the team and the town was that for the first 50 years of the team's existence or so, the Packers were on their deathbed pretty much all the time. And through the Press-Gazette and through the town, they were preserved. And now the team is trying to preserve the town. And, you know, Green Bay is about the same size as Boulder, Colorado, but doesn't attract entrepreneurial investment at the same rate as Boulder, Colorado. And so Titletown is one way in which they're trying to do that. There's a Titletown tech development there that's trying to encourage high-tech entrepreneurial sponsorship. I don't know if it's going to work. I mean, it seems like a decent idea. But the Packers have a vested interest in seeing that the city of Green Bay survives, because the value of that team is, in a lot of ways, the name of that town.
And speaking of community connections, we should probably talk briefly about Milwaukee. It's sometimes written that the Packers benefited quite greatly and that Milwaukee helped keep the franchise alive by the decades when the Packers played games in Milwaukee. Is that right?
Yeah, starting in 1933, the Packers played anywhere from 1 to 3 to 4 games, I think, in Milwaukee every year. The 1939 title game between the Packers and the Giants was actually played in Milwaukee instead of in Green Bay, where it should have been played by rules. But the NFL wanted to make sure they got enough revenue. And so they played the game at State Fair Park, I believe. So Milwaukee was important to the survival of the Packers. Fred Miller, he was the owner, but he was also the son of the founder, or the grandson of the founder of Miller Brewery, was one of the big stock buyers in 1950. I think he purchased the maximum 200 shares to make sure that the Packers stayed alive. You know, people in Green Bay were wary of Fred Miller because they were worried that he wanted to move the team to Milwaukee. And, that the fear that the team would move to Milwaukee was one of the impetuses behind the building of what was then New City Stadium, which became Lambeau Field in 1957. You know, I think in 96 or so, the team found that playing games in Milwaukee every year were essentially road games and they were costing the team money. And so they stopped doing it. But that was after the Packers had become a profitable concern beyond, in the more modern NFL, where they had a TV deal and things like that. But Milwaukee for many years ensured that the Packers could survive. And now the Packers are so popular, the relationship with Milwaukee is somewhat more at arm's length. I think there's still a gold package for Milwaukee season ticket holders from the old days. But, it's not the same as it used to be.
Right. Their time in Milwaukee and certainly in Green Bay also triggered a lot of thoughts, especially during the era in the 60s of the very successful coach Vince Lombardi. At many functions, Lombardi was quoted. The values of good character and hard work were emphasized. Did that really translate to a wide part of Wisconsin, do you think?
I think, a great metaphor for that is, when John McCain was shot down in Vietnam over Hanoi and was tortured by his captors in the early days and asked to divulge names of the men in his unit, John McCain gave them the names of the Packers' starting offensive line because the Packers were seen as bastions of virtue by not just the city of Green Bay anymore, but by the wider world. And I think that included Wisconsin, certainly.
Now, as to the players, they have had some well-behaved players and also some not so well-behaved, and that's like society, right? I'm thinking of Paul Hornung, Brett Favre, very talented, but also had their moments off the field that today are maybe cringeworthy. Can you talk a little bit about at least those two players?
Well, those two. I mean, Hornung was certainly seen as a he was had a reputation as an off-field carouser that preceded Vince Lombardi and was seen as wasting his talent. He was a number one draft pick. He was a first overall draft pick. So he was seen as wasting his talent until Lombardi showed up and turned him into his, as he told Horning when he arrived, you're my left halfback. You're my Frank Gifford. Lombardi had been the offensive coordinator of the Giants, who turned Gifford into a star in New York, and he did much the same with Horning, who was the plunging dagger of the Packers sweep. You always hear about the Packers sweep. The classic Packers sweep is the Packers going right, with Jim Taylor as the lead blocker for Paul Horning, deciding to go inside or outside. And Horning, I think, you know, though he became a great player, never stopped being a good time guy. And I think Brett Favre is much the same way. I think people were surprised when Ron Wolf traded a first-round pick for him. But he, in many ways, I think Brett Favre's, you know, good-time lifestyle, which transcended from the field, his demeanor on the field to his demeanor off the field, endeared him to the people of Wisconsin. But the Packers have had many other good-time players in their history. Johnny, going all the way back to the 30s, Johnny Blood was, you know, a lovable rogue, who was a, you know, an erudite Shakespeare-quoting guy in the barroom off the field, and was the first big play threat in the game in the 1920s. You know, and they had players like that all through their history. Ted Frisch was tremendously popular in the 40s. I don't think he had quite the reputation of Johnny Blood, but was a Wisconsin boy who was beloved by the locals as not just a good player, but a popular figure.
The issue of race has also come up during the Packers' history.
Yep.
The Packers and their supporters like to talk about Vince Lombardi being a big advocate for African-American players. Is that true? And how about overall, how well have the Packers done on the race issue?
Well, according to my research, specifically on the Lombardi issue, the Packers were good on race. Lombardi was adamant that his team was colorblind, was not going to be defined by how it viewed color. And he was clear about that with the city leaders of Green Bay. You know, he had a meeting with, I believe, the local restaurateurs and the local bar owners, where he said that if you deny service to any of my black players, you're not going to get business from any of my players. And that was sort of like how, you know, he laid down the law in Green Bay. Dave Robinson, the great linebacker from the 60s, a Hall of Fame linebacker, said that he turned Green Bay into a colorblind town. In terms of the Packers, now Green Bay, of course, was not a colorblind town. If you go back earlier in the team's history, no black player, Curly Lambeau never knowingly employed a black player, an African-American player. He had one, Walter Jean, who identified as white and was seen as white, but was mixed race. He played for the Packers for a couple years in the 20s. You know, one of the first things Gene Renzani, who took over in 1950, did was he started to bring black players in for a tryout because he knew that the face of the NFL was changing. Black players had been allowed unofficially in the league because the league never had an official color barrier since 1946, but not a one had ever played for Curly Lambeau and the Packers. And so he started bringing players in for tryouts. And in 1950, Bob Mann, an end, played for the Packers at the end of the season and began playing for them for a couple of years in the 50s. And from then on, Green Bay was a mixed-race team. But it was not a smooth transition. Ted Frisch actually played a small role in the integration of pro football. Ted Frisch was signed by the Cleveland Browns of the All-America Football Conference in 1946, and he got cold feet, and he came back to the Packers. And because Ted Frisch came back to the Packers, the Browns needed a fullback, and Paul Brown went out and got Marion Motley, one of the greatest fullbacks and players of all time, and also one of the first four African-Americans in pro football in the 40s after the soft ban on blacks that began in 1934.
The Packers, we've been talking about their successes and their pluses and some minuses. One other lesson they've taught, I think, in their years when they haven't been very good, and much of the 1950s and much of the 70s and 80s was the issue of humility.
I think that the humility in terms of, you know, in terms of the Packers, and especially in the 70s and 80s, losing becomes so ingrained. Bob Harlan told me when he took over that things were never going to change if we kept doing business the same way. And so he brought in his own football guy who he put in charge of everything football. And Ron Wolf's comment to me was like, when he came down and saw the Packers at the end of like a, you know, I think they went 6-10 or 4-12 the year Wolf took over. People were okay with that. And so it wasn't so much humility as it was, you know, a certain acceptance of losing had come in. And Lombardi saw the same thing when he came in 1959, and he was not going to tolerate it. You know, he re-wallpapered and redecorated the Packers' offices. Both Ron Wolf and Vince Lombardi were not going to accept the culture of losing, and so set about changing that. I think that was very important to the revival of the franchise both times. You know, people were still going to the games, but there were a lot of no-shows in the 80s. You know, Packers were becoming a bad draw in Milwaukee and at home in the 50s. And I think both Lombardi and Wolf saw that and acted quickly to change things around.
So it's good to be humble but not inept, maybe?
Yeah, I think so. I think winning cures a lot of what ails you, and I think Ron Wolf and Vince Lombardi were both all about winning when they got it to Green Bay.
So it's been a fascinating century for the Packers. Looking ahead, they are one of the teams, of course, in the NFL, and the NFL has been dealing with issues like the head injury problem for a while now. They've been gradually more acknowledging the head injury issue. Will there be a second strong century for the Packers and professional football?
You know, I'm curious to see. My son is about 10 years old. I'm curious to see that. I already see parents opting for flag football over tackle football at his age. You know, I'm curious to see how many kids are still coming up in the game. But I think football is still a very popular sport in America. I think football is in a lot of ways still, I don't know if you call it oversubscribed, but it's at the root of a lot of college athletics for a reason, you know, in terms of their revenue draw, because it's still a tremendously popular thing to watch and to play. So I'm curious to see where it goes, but I'm not sure. I don't know that the head injury thing has been totally figured out, but I think the NFL has a problem on their hands, and I think it'll be interesting to see how they handle it going forward. And the Packers have not had to deal with it per se, but they are part of the NFL, and they are part of the revenue arm of the NFL. And so they pay very close attention to what is good for the NFL. And, I think you can expect that the Packers to follow the NFL line on head injuries going forward.
Mark Beach is the author of The People's Team, an illustrated history of the Green Bay Packers. Beach spoke with WUWM's Chuck Quernbach, and the author will be in Milwaukee this Thursday at Boswell Book Company. You can find more of our reporting on the Green Bay Packers at WUWM.com. And that's today's edition of the show. I'm Joy Powers. Thanks so much for tuning in today, and please join us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. It's 11 o'clock, and stay tuned. Fresh Air is next.